Today, we're going to air an interesting discussion that took place between my co-host Drew and an influential Christian thinker and writer, Mike McCarg. Mike is a fascinating guy. Known by most by the alias Science Mike, he hosts the popular podcast The Liturgist and is the author of the recent book Finding God in the Waves. Now, Drew and Mike's discussion is wide-ranging, but I think the most interesting part for me comes towards the end, when Drew and Mike talk about what many see as the traditional Christian conception of salvation. You see, Drew asks Mike if he ever worries that his progressive views might be inadvertently leading people away from the correct view of God, and even to hell. Mike goes on to summarily dismiss this concern because, to him, this view of God and salvation just doesn't make any logical sense. And the thing is, to a degree, I actually agree with Mike when it comes to this view. The view that if you don't believe in the right theology, then you go to hell. This view just doesn't make any logical or ethical sense to me either. But I think the problem with this coming from Mike, a Christian, is that nevertheless, this does seem to be something that Jesus claims in the Gospels, this traditional view of hell, at least as I see it. You see, much of the time, and this is something that will come up again later in Hinge, Jesus is deliberately ambiguous in his teachings. But strikingly, when it comes to hell, this doesn't seem to be the case. Rather, Jesus at least seems to say that if you don't abide in him, then you go to hell, full stop. In any case, let's get into Drew and Mike's discussion. Their conversation is funny, personal, informative, and we know that you guys are going to enjoy it.
Man, I've got to say, you know, I don't know how many books I read last year, maybe 35, 40. Your book, Finding God in the Waves, was absolutely far and away just the book that had the biggest impact on me. And I don't think, I know I'm not alone in that with among people who read your book that, you know, there are a lot of books that you jump into that are intelligent, and you glean a lot of useful and helpful information from, and there are probably a decent number of books that are honest and have just vulnerable stories, but it's hard to find too many books where you have both. And I feel like your book, it's hard to think of too many that capture both at the same time like yours did.
Wow, thank you.
Yeah.
That's kind.
Yeah, well, absolutely. So let's just jump in for those who haven't heard your story, if you can just kind of take us through the crux of your journey over the last few years.
I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church, so like really hardcore conservative evangelical, and loved it. It's a great experience, especially because I was a bullied kid. So I had a sense of belonging and acceptance at church that I didn't get in school or in other parts of my life. And I also experienced a relationship with God in a very personal way. And that made me feel loved and accepted when other kids didn't. And that meant that I felt closer to God than any person, closer to God than my parents, closer to God than the few friends I had. God never made fun of me. God never pantsed me, right? So that really set up how my life unfolded. So as an adult, I was a Southern Baptist deacon. I was a Sunday school teacher. And I like meant it. I wasn't just performative in my faith. It was really the backbone of my entire life experience. And I got married when I was in my early 20s. So by the time I was 25, I was a deacon, a Sunday school teacher, a corporate vice president, a father. Just all the like good white Baptist check marks of a good life.
Perfect Southern Baptist resume.
Perfect Southern Baptist resume, absolutely. And I think I still would be. But my dad, who was also a deacon and a music minister, had an affair, and so he's going to leave my mom. And that led to all kinds of introspection for me, and also kind of an intervention. As a Southern Baptist deacon, I couldn't support that. So I tried to talk to my dad about God's plan for marriage, which is hilarious, right? He's been married more than 30 years, and I'm lecturing him, and I've been married, you know, way much less. So I decided I would like try to memorize the Bible so that I would have the best words to tell my father about marriage, God's own words. So I read the Bible in 3 months, and then I did that again and again and again. So I read 4 times in a year. And instead of like giving me answers and making me feel confident in my faith, that actually started to erode it. So by the end of that year, I was an atheist. So it's tough being a Southern Baptist deacon atheist, because like, what do you, how do you tell people? You, in my case, you don't. So for a couple of years, I just pretended to be a Christian, and that was a real good time. So online, I was, you know, on Reddit atheism and Freethinker forums, and just, yeah, we got to get this religion out of the world. And in person, I was like, if you were to die tonight, stand before the Father, and he would say, well, I shall let you into my kingdom of heaven. Now, I didn't really do that, but I did, like, I led my daughter to Christ and taught Sunday school and the whole thing. So it was a really divided time, and that wasn't sustainable. So eventually, my wife kind of interrogated me about what was going on, and that led to a small group of people in my life knowing I didn't believe anymore. And the fact that that went okay made me think, well, maybe I could just be an atheist, like, publicly, and it'll be fine. Maybe it won't be like the end of the world.
Now, at what point in your journey is this when your wife finds out what's going on with you? Like, how far into this experience are you at this point?
I haven't believed in 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's 2.5 years after I started this kind of fanatical Bible reading program.
And what was it like? Was she starting to suspect a while before what was going on with you, and you would just kind of brush aside questions? Like,
no, she never really asked until that one night, and then she's like, what's going on with you? And I was kind of evasive, and so I think she got worried that it was like a gambling problem or an affair or something, you know. So she was pretty blindsided. I was like, no, it's not I just don't believe in God, which I think was more shocking than, I mean, it's hard to understand if you haven't ever been in the evangelical conservative church. Like, for most people, it's like, oh, well, that's interesting. But that's like, oh my gosh, you're going to hell, right? Like, it's a huge thing. So, yeah, so she kind of beat it out of me. And I was really comfortable. Like, it felt good to not be holding this secret, to have some people kind of in on it. So I kind of wanted to let everybody in on it. And that was my plan, was to figure out how to get to that point. But instead, I went to California for a conference on creativity with a bunch of pastors, which I was kind of hesitant to do, but I worked in advertising, so it seemed like really necessary career work. And while I was at that conference, I had a mystical experience. And these are things that have been documented in the sciences. They're not, you know, I mean, it's weird, but it's not as weird as it sounds. But I heard an audible voice that I ascribed to Jesus, which is funny because I didn't believe at that point in my life that Jesus was an actual historical figure. And then I had a...
So let me stop you there. Did he introduce himself as Jesus? Why did you...
No, it was kind of the reference. I was being offered the Eucharist, which I did not want to take. Because I wasn't a Christian. And as I went to like turn around in protest/disgust, I heard a voice say, I was there when you were 8 and I'm here now. And that reminded me of, you know, kids beating me up on the playground and hiding in the trees praying. And so, you know, I took the Eucharist. And then I went out on the beach to pray some hours later in the middle of the night. And by pray, I mean kind of shout accusations at a God I didn't believe in.
I think that's a third of the Psalms right there.
So, yeah, I mean, yeah. Definitely.
People don't realize.
That's true. Yeah, that's definitely true. Because I read the Bible every day again, and I'm actually in the Psalms right now. So And I just saw this light. It's very hard to describe, but kind of, if you would imagine like the air itself, I'm making hand gestures like people listening can see.
I can see it.
Like a sheet. And when you kind of stretch a sheet, you can see through it if there's light on the other side. It was kind of like that, like this glowing light. And the light got brighter and closer until it just sort of enveloped me. And it's like time froze, like the waves just kind of stopped. And then I was just in this divine presence. And it was really strange for me. Kind of a atheist God encounter. So I had this kind of divided approach. One, I like emailed my wife and my mom and said I had this experience. I don't know what it means. And I called my neurologist for an appointment because I thought I might have a brain tumor because I was hearing voices and seeing bright lights. And I got a CAT scan and an MRI. And there's no brain tumor. So I asked for a psychological evaluation at the local psychiatric center. I said, I'm having hallucinations and hearing voices. So tell us more about that. I said, give me the tests. They did. And I remember this one psychiatrist said, I don't think you're crazy. I just think you're religious. So here I am, like an intellectual atheist who's had this deeply experiential moment with God, trying to figure that out. So I tried to study the Bible again, couldn't. It made me so cynical. It just seemed like ridiculous. Seemed just as backwards as it was when it drove me away from faith. So I tried to read like theologians and like John Shelby Spong or Paul Tillich wouldn't make me actually vomit, just lightly retch. But everyone else, I was like, what are you? This is fan fiction. There's no basis in reality here. So doing all that made me feel more distant from that light, made me doubt the experience. So I turned instead to try to figure out, is there space for God in the universe? So that's cosmology, that's physics. So I studied that, and I did find that if you view the world kind of in a Spinoza way or an Einstein way, you can approach the beautiful, mysterious, mechanistic order behind reality in a very mystical way. And you can even call that God. But that's not a God that shows up at the beach in a bright light or speaks in a voice or really intervenes consciously in any way in reality, or that you could even call conscious. So then I started studying neuroscience to figure out how people have these experiences. And it was through that that I sort of discovered that, contrary to what I sort of had read as an atheist in Critique of Faith, that many neuroscientists say that faith practiced well is really good for people and really good for the brain. So even if I couldn't like answer the is there a personal God question, which I still can't today, I could rest in the fact that the spiritual practice I long for as a result of that light, A, wasn't intellectually dishonest, and B, was actually good for me. And it's through that practice of faith that I started to encounter the God the Christian mystics talk about. And that's led to me where I'm at, where I'm today. I'm like this science-minded empiricist with a mystical faith. And that's completely changed my life, oddly enough. Not just personally, it's changed what I do, because now, like for a living, I talk to people about the intersection of science and mysticism to help science-minded people get a toehold to understand what the heck people of faith are talking about, which I think is helpful and useful. Not to convince them to be people of faith themselves, but they can understand like what's happening in the brain and why this is a thing. I feel like we can have better conversations. And the other thing I do in my work is help people who like long for spiritual experience, but skepticism kind of keeps it from happening. Offering them some tips from my own life and from my studies about how they could do that.
Yeah.
That's what I do.
It's so fascinating. It's such a unique angle to be coming from. I'm curious, what is the exact point after you had this experience and you're just encompassed by doubt about it? Seeing the neurologist, getting a CAT scan, all these things. Like, what was the point where you said, you know what, there's not something wrong with me? What was that transition like?
I don't know if there was one.
Kind of gradual.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's still sometimes I'm like, man, is my brain just weird? Why do I have these really powerful experiences that a lot of other people seem to even desire and not have? But now, you know, I just view it as part of who I am, as a gift. And that's, I think that's mainly a lot of therapy. I think I saw a therapist for a while and it helped.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's such a unique aspect because, so I'll give you a little bit of background on myself and what we're doing here. My own story in some ways is so similar to yours, and in other ways, it's the exact opposite. So I was a pastor in Los Angeles, and I had some doubts that were percolating for a number of months, and I was an assistant pastor at this pretty large PCA church, so similar environment to you where very conservative, good, reformed, theologically sound Christians. And there was this day where I was preaching at our three services about truth. And I was rooting my sermon in just kind of the cultural-wide personal search for truth, this craving for truth that we all feel. Like, how can I find something that's true, something that I can depend on is true? And I was connecting that to just the call that we all have to speak words of truth and to be truth tellers. Mm-hmm. And of course, mm-hmm. Jesus is the ultimate answer for truth. And as I was hitting on those questions of what really is truth, just that genuine central human craving, I found myself thinking, gosh, like, I think I'm asking that same question right now. And maybe before today, I didn't even quite realize it. And I'm preaching at our first service. I'm literally on stage in front of maybe 700, 800 people at that point. And the doubts just began to consume me intellectually. But I pushed through the rest of that sermon, kind of wondering if I'm lying to people as I make the transitions to saying Jesus is the ultimate answer in your search for truth. And I had this just emotionally overwhelming day, pushing through the other two sermons, but literally spending all of my free time backstage in the bathroom, throwing up, bawling, finding a friend of mine who could relate to doubts, just consoling me throughout the day. And since that season, I've kind of, it's not like you ever get rid of doubt, but I'd say, back to being something, definitely a believer and something of a mainstream Christian, though like you, that looks a lot different than it did before.
Right.
But a big difference in our stories is, I think you have a lot more intellectual reservation, but you've had these personal experiences that really, that have told you there's something true here. I'm the exact opposite. I think through, reason and intellectual thought, I've come back to believing, you know what, this really is true. And there's this like two-sided part of me where on one hand, I really want a personal experience to validate what I find to be true. But on the other hand, I find myself so skeptical of personal experiences. Yeah. I think I would have the exact same reaction that you did. But what I find interesting, and so all that to say, now I'm doing this podcast with an atheist friend of mine, getting into doubt, getting into faith, trying to wrestle with who really was Jesus, who really is Jesus now. And I think your story is going to be particularly compelling for him because he definitely has the stance of, look, you know, when people have these spiritual experiences, it's because they've set up their brains to want it. And so mm-hmm. their brain is just giving them what they already naturally wanted. I mean, have you come across other people who have similar stories where they weren't wanting an experience like that by any means, and it just kind of hit them out of the blue in a way that they couldn't deny it?
Yeah, I've run into a handful of folks. I've run into some folks who really didn't have any religious history, grew up in non-religious contexts, and then they had some experience like mine that then they placed into like a Christian context. That's how they became Christians. I've had a few people who have those experiences and like me, they were past the point of desiring it. I've had some people have had those experiences and said, oh, well, that was an interesting thing that happened in my brain and it didn't cause a return to faith. There's a guy named Pete Holmes. He's a comedian. He's got a TV show. And I talked to him on occasion. And I think my understanding of Pete's life is he's had some pretty powerful moments in the light, but he doesn't then place those like in a specific religious tradition. He just lets them kind of exist as this mystery. So I think there's a huge variety of how the experiences happen and in what context, and then the outcome can be very different. The one common thing you'll see overwhelmingly in the data, people who say they've had a mystical experience also report that their life was permanently changed by it. It's just a matter of what that means.
Yeah. Just another quick plug. In addition to your book, I have no idea how many podcast episodes I've listened to. I have conflict with my wife over how much I'll be walking around the house with headphones on, and she's like, "You're not present with me," and I'm like, "I'm here. Just tell me, and I'll pause it and take them off." Yeah. But I don't know how many thousands of podcast episodes I've listened to, but your 2014 episode with Pete Holmes, I know this is kind of the beginning of this whole journey for you and this career turn for you where you initially publicly share your journey and your experience. I mean, I can't imagine how scary that was, but that is probably one of my three or four favorite podcast episodes I've ever listened
to. It was a good time. Yeah. I didn't know that would be like a, I didn't know what that would like do. It's just, Pete was a friend of Rob's, and so I met him, and he's like, "Oh, you should come on my podcast." I was like, "Okay." I'd never heard of his podcast.
Yeah.
or him.
Wow.
and so then I was like, "Man, it's weird." I looked up his show, and I was like, "Wow, some really notable people have been on here." And then I listened to the show, and I'm like, "Holy cow, this is an amazing program." And then I got intimidated.
Yeah.
Like if I had to do it over again, I wouldn't have, because he had like some of my all-time favorite comedians on his show before I came on. But yeah, and I didn't expect like, that changed, that podcast really changed everything. It was pretty wild. Because it was around the same time I went on that show, Michael Gunger and I started The Liturgists. And so those two things happening at the same time, like, had a pretty dramatic effect.
Yeah, yeah. I can't imagine. Because at the time you were working in advertising, you said.
Full time.
And then you just decided to quit your job, start writing a book, got a publishing deal. Like, how did all that play out after that point?
Well, first I just answered the phone. So people would like look me up in the phone book or on LinkedIn. People would call my ad agency and ask me, like, "Hey, we'd like to come speak at our conference or our church or whatever." I'd be like, "Okay." And they'd be like, "Hey, do you have a writer?" And I was like, "What's a writer?" And I would just be, you know, I'd be like, "Can you pay for the flight in the hotel room?" Yeah. And so I just started doing that all the time, to the point that it started to really hurt my family financially, because I was just volunteering. And I ran out of vacation days, so I started doing unpaid days from work. So then I started telling people, I was like, "I can come, but you have to, like, pay what I would make at work, or so that otherwise, like, we're having trouble paying our bills because I do this so much." So then people started to pay me like what I made a day at my ad job, and so I just kept doing, and then I got to do so many events. By the way, Michael and I are making like a liturgy a month, and it's exhausting. And then we start this podcast, so then more people call. So I remember one day I was like, I had landed at the airport, and I was trying to call the person to who was going to pick me up. And then I got call waiting. I was like, well, I see you, so hold on. So it was another person who was the next event I was going to. And then I got another call and I switched over and it was someone trying to book me. And I was like, well, I can't keep doing this myself. So I like worked with a company to start managing my events, which then I started getting even more events because people could actually get in touch with them. And I remember my boss one day called me in and he said, hey, do you still work here? I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, I mean, you do good work, but we don't see you very often.
Yeah. You do great work, but you never work.
you're never here. So we made this transition plan for like, you know, the X number of months I would stay on. And then I was really worried about like how we would pay our bills on the other side of that. Hmm. And right in that process, signed the book deal. And I started a Patreon for Ask Science Mike, and it's like a huge pay cut from my ad job, but it was enough for us to get by, and that was it. The next thing I knew, I was a full-time author, speaker, podcaster, which is nothing I'd ever envisioned or planned for my life, ever. I've done a lot of startups. I'm an entrepreneur, but I've never thought about anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such, as someone who's just starting to make some of that transition now, it is such an awkward transition to say, hey, I have something to put out there. I think you're going to gain something meaningful from listening to my material and what I may have to say. It's such an awkward transition to do something like that. But in a lot of ways, you're kind of a minister to a specific set of people, like not in the classic minister sense, but in a lot of ways, like for those who are going to go and read your book, listen to some of your podcasts, listen to the Liturgist podcast. I mean, you really are a minister for a specific population. Can you talk about the kinds of people that you're trying to reach the most?
I call them the spiritually homeless and frustrated. What does it mean to be spiritually homeless? Like no one around you gets you. So maybe you're a skeptic and you just have this curiosity or this leaning, and all of your secular friends are like, hey, drop that. It's crazy. Or maybe you're in a church, but the way you view cosmology or evolution or marriage equality or something makes you the weirdo, and start to feel homeless. Maybe you have to like leave your community because it gets so bad. And that's who my work is for. It's for those people who don't quite fit in wherever they're at for whatever reason. What that looks like, about half the audience doesn't identify with any particular religious affiliation. And some are atheists, some are agnostics, some are just what you call spiritual, not religious. And then the other half is Christians, but like weird Christians. So there's a lot of progressive Christians. There are some conservative Christians who are just wondering like how to have better conversations about science. And so I don't know of any other media platform where you have that mixture, that much diversity on beliefs. And yet everybody kind of, like we can all get together in a room at Ask Science Mike Live, and there's not like fist fights. it's this kind of the sacred space where it's okay to just ask questions and coexist.
And so you take this, I guess, a position where obviously you've had these experiences that are specifically connected to Jesus. Like you said very clearly, you feel it was Jesus who spoke to you as you were taking the Eucharist. But at the same time, you don't necessarily push people who are seeking towards Jesus. How do you?
I don't push people who are seeking anywhere. Yeah, I'm not a pusher.
Yeah, and why is that? Well, if you've had this profound experience yourself, why not say, hey, if you come the same direction I've gone, like maybe you could have this experience as well?
Because maybe they could. But maybe they won't.
Yeah.
And these are people who very often have been let down over and over by gurus and guides and pastors and experts who've told them if they do something, their X is going to happen. And so I say, I don't know what's going to happen. I'll tell you what happened to me. I'll tell you what the science says will increase propensity for different behaviors if they interest you. But I try to lower the stakes as much as possible. I'm more about helping people find peace and contentment with where they've been and where they are, and be more open to the variety of things that could happen in the future than prescribing some particular path to them. Because I have to admit the weakness of my position, right? I've had these really powerful mystical personal experiences that were distinctly Jesus flavored, right? But I can't deny that people have very powerful experiences in the Buddhist tradition or the Islamic tradition or through simple mindfulness. It's hard for me to make some historic empirical fact claim about my faith. So I just don't. And I've found that in this era, that actually really increases my credibility with most people. I mean, in an age where the church is so self-assured and the political left and the political right are so self-assured, I think it's refreshing for people if someone will say, you know, I'm not sure about a lot of things. I'm curious.
Yeah.
And I'm gracious. I'm very uncertain.
Yeah. You know, I found that to be so true of my experience over the last couple of years that, you know, as a pastor, as a PCA pastor, I faced the same angst that I think a lot of evangelicals do, of they feel like they need to be talking about Jesus all the time and sharing Jesus with everyone, but no one wants to talk about Jesus with him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And they really don't want to have the conversations, but they know they should. And that was me for a lot of years. And then I entered into the season of doubt. And, you know, for a while I kept it private. And then at some point I kind of came out and became public with it, to where, you know, when people would ask me how I'm doing at a party and they're not intending to get into a deep conversation at all of a sudden they find themselves in a deep conversation with a pastor who's doubting his beliefs. I started to just become very open with it. And what I found was that actually I had some of the most profound conversations about Jesus and about spirituality and about Christianity that I ever had. And people had so much more interest once they sensed a degree of humility and openness within me that absolutely was never there when I entered with that self-assured posture that you mentioned. Well, let me ask this, because this is a question that I kind of experience a lot of internal conflict over. I'm kind of someone who has a foot in the progressive stream of Christianity and a foot in the conservative stream of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And as you and obviously you're a little bit further in the spectrum of progressive belief.
I was about to say, I have like a pinky toe in progressive. and a foot in atheism.
Oh yeah, yeah. Interesting. Interesting. Depending on the day, I'm sure.
Yeah, depending on the day.
Like, what does doubt look like for you now? Like, do you ever doubt that maybe as weird as it seems, that conservative Christianity could ultimately be true? Or obviously it sounds like you battle with doubt over maybe there is no God at the end of the day and these were just kind of brain induced experiences. But like, what is, as you've gone through this journey filled with doubt, filled with questioning, filled with searching, now as you find yourself in some way on the other side of the bank, what kinds of things do you find yourself wrestling over now?
This would be the most terrible answer in the history of radio. Nothing. I doubt things all the time. I doubt my understanding of the world, but I relish it. I don't have any fear or anxiety associated with doubt. Doubt is just a way of testing ideas. My faith has room for God is just something that happened in my brain. So what? That doesn't provoke in me even the mildest form of anxiety or concern or fear. But it would not diminish the experience in any way. It would not diminish the degree to which it's changed my life. It would not diminish my enthusiasm for a faith that can produce those moments. So this is the thing about contemplative mysticism. It's all about releasing and letting go and surrendering. So any idea of mine can float away. And that's just part of life. I look forward to it. If there's things I wrestle with or I worry about, it's, are my actions really producing good results? Are there things I'm not aware of that I could be doing better that would be more helpful? What will future generations say in terms of what I did to the climate or how my actions impacted marginalized people? What does it mean to make a new heaven and a new earth? What does it mean to draw the kingdom of God near? I wrestle with that all the time. But the kind of, I don't make an idol out of my ideas anymore. And this kind of Pauline notion of the test and the evidence of a grace through faith is a fruit. What is the fruit of my life? What are the things that I think on? As Paul says, think on these things. Am I renewing my mind daily? If I'm doing those things, then all the theological, systematic, whatever. The gospel shows up when we get our hands dirty, not when we sharpen our pencils.
Yeah, that's a great statement. This may be a more precise way to get at something I've been trying to think of. You grew up obviously in these very conservative streams of Christianity. We're in it for decades. Do you face any doubt or any questioning or second guessing that after being in it for so long, that this conservative version of the Christian God, where everyone should be coming to faith in Jesus,
right,
do you wrestle with any doubt about that being true?
None. Zero. I know so many people who do. I get hundreds of emails a month from people saying, okay, I've had my eyes open to this, but what if we're wrong? What if I'm going to hell? What if I'm sending other people to hell? All that stuff fell apart for me as an atheist. It's too easy for me to critique that notion, right? Why is that the one right theology? If I'm going to worry about that, why don't I worry that I'm actually an infidel against the Prophet Muhammad? What? How do we know? Why would that be the one right exclusive faith claim? And I've never seen anyone even remotely make a rationally compelling claim as to why those particular relatively recent notions in Protestant American Christianity are the one true expression of religious faith. That's sort of the gift I've been given, is to have all that stuff fall down in a period of total unbelief in God, so that when I re-engage with faith, when I begin to know God again, I'd already unpacked that suitcase. I'm not trying to carry that trunk onto the plane, right? So I literally never think about that unless someone asks me. And then I immediately think, yeah, why? It just doesn't make, to me, any logical sense to worry about that. So when people worry about that, it's because they've had some social conditioning that was designed to produce that particular anxiety to keep them in a right belief set in a social community. And I think they need to do more emotional work than they need to do fact-finding or rational analysis.
So one of the things you talk about very, very
which
openly,
I can't, but by the way, I can't believe I say things like that, and there are still evangelicals in my audience. Their people are amazing.
Well, I think it speaks to just this cultural craving that we have in such a unique moment right now, where I think we're all craving humility and we don't even know it. With two sides, especially in the political spectrum, that are so self-assured.
Really unbelievably self-assured.
That when you hear humility, it just, it grabs people's attention. But one of the, certainly one of the interesting bits of your story in the book are just the relationships in your life, whether it's the relationship with your parents or especially the relationship with your wife. You know, I think a big thing that people are struggling with right now with the divide between conservatives and liberals, and this is something I'm experiencing in my own life, is a sense of loss. A family and friends who you thought you understood, and you thought they understood you, and all of a sudden they support Trump, and you have no idea why, and you can't figure it out, and it feels like, how are we so different? And in some ways it can feel like a loss of a relationship. And your story with your wife, where you talk about it being the first time that there was an iron curtain when you guys went to bed at night, and after years of marriage, it's so powerful, because I think to lesser degrees we're experiencing that right now with the political divide. I kind of forgot where I was going with that.
I've been there.
I started with a question, and then I got to talking and forgot what the question was. But how about we go into that a little bit more? What I'd really love to hear is, as you express just this, like you've moved past these conservative ideals, but you obviously have a family that at least was conservative. What are their thoughts and opinions now? Have they kind of moved with you, or do they still have both feet in the conservative circles?
I think my wife has moved with me. I think my kids certainly have a more progressive or open view of God than they would have had otherwise. I think my mom's exactly where she was, but able to create space for where I am. So mom goes to church with us. She's certainly a lot more theologically conservative than I am. But mom's conservatism has always been the big-hearted kind. Like the credit to the faith I was raised in. Dad is conservative. Dad voted for Trump, but he loves me and supports me, and I love and support him. I think the rest of my extended family, I'm like weird. There's definitely a palpable difference at Thanksgiving. But they're kind. But I've noticed. With some members of my family, a new distance. It's just part of it, I guess. I know that, like, most of the people, not my family, but my close friends from a few years ago, they're just none of them around anymore. They've all moved on. I see some of them like once a year, but a lot of those relationships didn't cross the bridge, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to hear more about you and your wife's journey. So if you could start with just kind of going into a little bit more of that story of the impact that you coming out and saying, look, I don't know that I believe in God right now, the impact that had on your relationship with your wife, but also what have things looked like for her since you said has kind of come along with you on this journey?
Well, it was rough at first.
Yeah.
Really rough at first. It was the hardest thing we've ever had in our marriage, really. I lied to her for like 2.5 years.
Jeez.
So I think it was the I think the theology masked, that discussion masked the greater thing, is like, how could I have not known this about my husband? And what else could he be hiding? But the process of getting through that gave us a whole new set of tools in our relationship to be very honest while being very gracious. So in terms of our relationship, it's never been better than it has been since all this happened. She's gone through her own periods of doubt, incredulity at faith. She's not as esoteric in her thinking as I am, so that gets lived out in different ways. I think she holds her faith more loosely than she used to. But like, you know, in our house, obviously, like, if somebody's like, I'm not sure what I believe about things, that's not, we don't like throw the panic alarm when that happens. You know what I mean? Like when my daughter says, I don't know if I believe God is real. I'm like, okay, tell me about that. That sounds fun. I can't wait to have this conversation with you. So I think that's true in our relationship too. Wherever the day is leading, that's just part of the journey of life.
You know, one thing I want to go back to is just the simple reaction that you said you would have to your daughter if she kind of walked into the room and started talking about doubt right now, is like, this is fun. You know, that's a big thing we're trying to capture in our podcast about Jesus between me and my atheist partner, is here's this really unique story that has impacted the rest of history and a lot of the Western values that we've come to have. This unbelievable, beautiful story of Jesus. Here's what we know about church history. Here's what we know about first century history and documentation. We have these four biographies. Here are all these things that have happened. There are millions of people that have had experiences related to this man. You know, forget my side that says it all actually happened. Forget my friend's side, my partner's side that said, no, it didn't actually happen. But how about we engage in this together and say, like, what a unique mystery this is. And like, how about we enter into this with a sense of wonder? I think in a lot of ways, we're trying to model that kind of sense of wonder with regard to these questions that usually, I like your word of panic, either inspire a sense of panic or just some kind of negative reaction. I find that to be just such a necessary thing that we need, or aspect that we need with regard to these kinds of conversations right now. Well, man, what happens next? So you went on this journey, you wrote this book, the Liturgist podcast is blowing up. I mean, where do you go from here?
Wherever the day leads. My plan hasn't changed. I answer the phone. I answer questions. I go where the audience leads. So we've got some liturgist gatherings coming up. We've launched this subscription-based meditation program. And I like that every day I just wake up and I see what people are saying and I respond to it. I'm just going to keep doing that. And as long as it works, this is what I'll do. If at some point it's people stop being interested, then I'll go get a job. But I don't have some grand plan. I'm just trying to live vulnerably and honestly in this strange ethereal community that's gathered around this work. I think it seems to be important. I couldn't help but smile the other day because the Liturgist podcast, Pete N's new podcast, and the Robcast were the top three shows in religion and spirituality on iTunes, even ahead of good old Joel Osteen. And there's obviously some hunger I don't want to say for a new take on Christianity. That's not what it is. For a more open, honest, and humble way to follow Jesus today. And I'm really grateful I get to be a part of that.
Yeah, that's cool. Do you have plans for a next book?
I do, yeah. Working on that right now. Back and forth with the publisher.
Are you sharing anything about that?
I mean, if I do, it won't be the book that ships, right? So I'm really collaborative, and I've got a publisher that's really collaborative. So even at the very beginning stages, there's a lot of back and forth on the general premise and direction of the book. So like it kind of started, my original idea was a book called More Than Alive, because like a sponge is alive, but hopefully our faith makes us more than just alive. And the subtext in that, they became more interested in about this idea of like, why do we do what we don't want to do? Much like Paul wrote in Romans.
Yeah.
And so right now the book seems to be heading in a cognitive neuroscience exploration of Paul's dilemma of why do I do what I don't want to do? And would kind of go through my recent examinations of trying to get on some terms with Paul, and explore his writings as I do, mainly through science.
Yeah. Is there a specific personal struggle that you have in mind that has inspired that journey of why do I do what I don't want to do?
Yes. After my mystical experience, did all this self-development work, and I got to a point where I really felt not in control, but I'd surrendered so much of my life that nothing I did surprised me. I was consistently kind and gracious, patient. And then I fell off a motorcycle and hit my head really hard and have a traumatic brain injury. And I've been having to relearn myself, and sometimes like, why did I do that? Why did I just snap at that person? Why am I so impatient? Why am I having an anxiety attack right now? And so I think that'll be kind of the animating energy for a lot of the content of the book. It's me going through that myself.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Well, let me ask you one more question. Certainly the people who are kind of tuning into the beginning of our podcast so far are largely people, just like you were describing, people who are on a journey of doubt and questioning and discovery. It's impossible to give the most precise advice for a wide group of people, but what would be your number one piece of advice for people who are in that stage of their journey now?
Don't panic. Don't panic. Everything's going to be okay. You're outgrowing some ideas you had. That's a good thing. Enjoy the process. Stop trying to rush towards the next island and enjoy sailing. you're going to be okay. You're going to eat. You're going to have a place to live. Lower the stakes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is great. Again, thank you so much for coming on. For those who are listening, buy Finding God in the Waves on Amazon right now. Literally the best book I read in 2016. Download the episode with Pete Holmes, You Made It Weird, where Pete Holmes talks to Science Mike. And of course, listen to the Liturgist podcast as well.
Okay, guys, that's going to be it for today. Thank you so much for listening. And once again, please remember to go out and share our Kickstarter with your friends and family. We've only got about a day left now to raise the rest of our $20,000 goal, and we're at just about 60%. So, you know, us making it past the finish line at this point really is up to you guys. Our fate is in your hands. Secrecy's a pattern.